Police are hunting for the man seen in a surveillance image from the airport moments before two blasts at the departure hall. Authorities have said he left a bag containing the biggest bomb that did not detonate as planned.
That's just absurd at a dozen different levels. I mean, why would you say to the people of California or New York State, you should not have a choice about who the Democratic nominee for president would be?
She's seen bullies her entire career, and I'll tell you, Heidi Cruz is not scared one iota by a bellowing Donald Trump.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It's 5:12 and it is Thursday, March 24th, 2016. Welcome to another business day and welcome to another day. It is the day before the big three-day holiday on the markets, so let's get right to the overnight market intel from the WGN market desk. European stocks are lower as the dollar strength has cut oil and mining shares this morning. Dow futures pointing down almost 64 points this morning. The Nasdaq is off. Nasdaq futures off about 20 points. Overseas, European stocks all lower. All of the indices lower there. The DAX leading them down almost 108 points this morning. In Asia, most of the stocks there down as well overnight. UK retail sales fell about 0.4% in February. Brussels' reaction to the terror attacks still having reverberations on airline stock and travel stocks this morning around the world and globally here in the United States as well on some of the futures, the pre-market trading. In other news this morning, Starbucks making big news this week, announcing that by the end of the year, it plans to donate about 5 million meals nationwide to people in need. Starbucks says its aim is to donate 100% of its unsold food. It is partnering with two national food charities, the Food Donation Connection and Feeding America. The idea came from baristas.
I think it's frustrating to throw away so much food, especially because you know that there are people that need it and that there's more things that we could do with it.
A promotional video on the Starbucks website yesterday, the coffee giant is set to donate things like paninis, salads, and other bistro sandwiches. It has been donating some of its breakfast to foods like donuts and other things, but this is actual food. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz says it has been a long time coming and took a little work.
I'm not looking for any pat on the back. This is not about a marketing thing. All we're trying to do is advance the cause of people who, for one reason or another, are being left behind. We are going to feed millions of people as a result of this campaign and our ability to put really good food in the hands of people who unfortunately would have gone hungry through the night.
Schultz says one of the biggest obstacles for Starbucks in doing this was to make sure that fresh items would be safe to feed hungry individuals, and so they've had to work with local municipalities, local governments to work through some of those challenges.
Our people just felt so badly, and this has been going on for quite some time, and so we started doing our homework municipality by municipality, and this was not an easy thing to kind of overcome because there are some issues here, but our people drove this. Food Life is a great partner, and as a result of that, here we are. And I think this is just a small gesture that I think is going to benefit millions of people.
Howard Schultz says these obstacles that stood in Starbucks' way are the same obstacles standing in the way of other corporations who would like to do the same thing, and says that there needs to be some national regulations or national oversight to help in this area. By the way, Feeding America, which is one of Starbucks' sponsors and partners in this, says that the U.S. wastes about 70 billion pounds of food every year. Coming up on the Opening Bell, we're going to take you to the New York Auto Show. We're going to talk about the latest Lincoln delivery there. It is wowing audiences at the biggest auto show in North America. And also later in the broadcast, we're going to have the very latest on the situation in Brussels, how that is impacting the markets. And we're also going to talk about a Twitter handle that a lot of people have been following, Startup L. Jackson. We now know who he is. We'll get to that in our next segment.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Asian stock markets have fallen for a second day after U.S. shares were pulled down by crude oil prices that have dropped back below $40 a barrel. On Wall Street, energy and mining companies led the decline, with the S&P 500 now in the red for the year. It shed 13 points yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 80, closing at 17,502. The NASDAQ Composite dropped 53 points. Virgin America may soon be on the market. The company, backed by British billionaire Richard Branson, is reportedly reaching out to potential buyers about selling part or all of the carrier. The discussion boosted Virgin America's stock price by 13% yesterday. And the Labor Department today will announce new rules that sharply reduce workplace exposure to silica, a potentially deadly mineral found in construction materials and the oil and gas industry. Safety experts have urged a tightening of the standards on silica since the 1970s. Affected companies have successfully fought new measures. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program. 520. For 4 years, an anonymous Twitter account delighted and perplexed the startup and tech world. Barb's dark funny advice, all of that kind of inside stuff the tech community ate up. 78,000 followers in the end for at Startup L. Jackson. We now know who he is. We're joined by Bloomberg business writer Ellen Hewitt, who's been writing about this. Ellen, who is Startup L. Jackson?
Yeah, the actual person behind the Twitter handle is a guy named Parker Thompson. It's a surprise in that he's not some of, you know, there were a lot of names that were batted around, the names of like big venture capitalists like Benedict Evans and Ben Horowitz. And it's not them, so that was kind of a surprise. What isn't surprising is it is a venture capitalist in San Francisco. So, you know, some of the more far off guesses people thought like, oh, maybe it's a Stanford student or someone who's, you know, completely unexpected. So it's sort of both. But he is a guy, he's a former angel investor, and then now he works at AngelList, which is kind of a platform for angel investors and very early startups to meet and sort of get funding. He's not technically an investor anymore, but he still does invest on the side.
He came onto Twitter with, I guess, ended up with about 78,000 followers. What was it about his feed that enthralled viewers and kept people coming back?
Yeah, I've asked a lot of people, you know, why they really liked him, and I always kind of get the same answer. He's really funny. If you ever just look through his tweets, some of them are quite sassy and pretty hilarious. And then he also gives out fairly straightforward advice for entrepreneurs. And one of the things I've noticed about Silicon Valley is that entrepreneurs seem to have an endless appetite for advice on how to run their business. I mean, there's constantly reading blog posts and Medium posts about, you know, how to deal with this or that problem. And Startup L. Jackson gave them, you know, a lot of information about what he thought was the best way to do things. And often they were delivered in pretty funny little packages. So I think it really was just tapped into something that people already had an appetite for.
And it was funny to see that some of his tweets were actually quoted by the tech media.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, it's a little weird because we have no idea who this person is, yet he had gained kind of a lot of authority within this very insular, you know, Silicon Valley tech bubble, and that includes the press. You know, we all kind of talked about him as if we knew who this was, and many of us had no idea. And obviously, the mystery sort of gives it an allure of its own. So a lot of people were interested in what he had to say, I think also in part because we had no idea who it was.
There were, as he disappeared from his Twitter feed, you write in your story that one person wrote sitting Shiva for Startup L. Jackson. This was what an entrepreneur wrote last month. What is it that, you know, caused him to go away from the feed? And is there a chance that he might come back? Because it sounds like people really miss his input, however covered it was or shrouded in mystery it was.
Yeah. So this is one of the more interesting things that I think I learned in talking to the real Startup L. Jackson, was his idea about what the purpose of the Twitter account was. And he sort of reflected on it himself, too. He said, you know, when he first started, it was just kind of a joke. He thought it'd be funny to have startup advice come from the voice of Daniel L. Jackson, specifically his character from Pulp Fiction. And the idea was to see whether startup advice, or advice really, could be given credence and, you know, could gain a following based only on the quality of what it was saying. So if nobody knew who it was, you know, could somebody's ideas gain traction in a place like Silicon Valley, where people often care a lot about where you went to school or, you know, what companies you've built or how much, you know, what investments have you made. And over, you know, 4.5 years, he proved that to be true, right? Like someone, people had no idea what this person's qualifications were, eventually became very well trusted based on the quality of his ideas. But in doing so, then Startup L. Jackson became this sort of thought leader of its own, and sort of it lost this sort of virgin testing ground for ideas. It just became, you know, he also became somebody that people would trust based solely on who it was rather than the quality of his ideas. So as Parker put it, you know, it became the very thing that it was critiquing, and therefore the experiment had run its course, and that's kind of why he wanted to retire it. So I think, you know, if he sticks to that reasoning, it's unlikely that he'll sort of pick it up in the same way that he had been doing it before.
But if the idea was to get people in Silicon Valley to listen to somebody who wasn't of their ilk, and that worked, it shows that perhaps that segment of the tech world is likely to do that in the future, do you think, or no? With somebody else?
I found it kind of heartening. It's true. Like, we had no idea, you know, based on, if you read his text or his tweets, at some point you realize, okay, this guy probably has investing experience, he probably has this and that, but really, there was no way to check. And people still really thought he was just a good person to, you know, get advice from. I mean, actual entrepreneurs reached out to the Twitter account to say, like, I know there's a real person behind here. Like, hey, I'm starting a fund. Can you give me some advice? Like, can we talk about what business decisions do you think I should make? And Parker would often meet with these people and just talk to them as himself. So it's interesting. It was this idea that, you know, people really came to trust a stranger. And I do think that's a pretty interesting thing to shown to have happened, and it does suggest capacity for it to happen again.
Do you think it also shows the need for this sort of open dialogue to exist in some way, that people are needing information and wanting information and want that dialogue, and they're not getting it in some current form now?
Yeah, another thing people talk to me about why they liked Startup L. Jackson so much was this ability that he had to be able to say whatever he wanted. You know, it's not like he was saying, you know, horrible things or really barbed things, but he did have a little bit of freedom to be sharp with Silicon Valley about its hypocrisies or things that he found lacking. So I do think there's a strong, you know, people want to be told sort of the unvarnished truth, and in some ways, a semi-anonymous Twitter account has the ability to do that in a way that you know, one attached to someone's name can't. So I mean, and now that we know who it is, like, Parker cannot keep doing things exactly the same way as he did when he was tweeting and no one knew who it was. So it will be interesting to see if maybe there's some sort of void that gets filled. It'll be hard to, I can replicate exactly what he did, but maybe it'll be shown in other ways.
I think it's the funny end note to this is that Parker Thompson's real Twitter account only has about 3,500 followers compared to the 78,000 for Startup L. Jackson.
Yeah, although in the days after the story came out, I think he probably doubled that number. He has maybe like 7,000 now. But it's never going to be, you know, the Startup L. Jackson kind of following that. I think most of them are just sad that he's gone and are not always going to, like, transfer over and follow Parker, right? He has a different style.
Ellen Hewitt is a writer for Bloomberg News. You can read her material at Bloomberg.com and follow her on Twitter at Ellen Hewitt, H-U-E-T.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:38. Welcome back to the program. Lincoln has unveiled the Navigator concept at the 2016 New York International Auto Show. The concept SUV is the next step in the company's plan to rebuild Lincoln into what it's calling a quiet luxury brand. Actor Matthew McConaughey added a little bit of star power to the Lincoln unveiling yesterday.
I'm pleased to be here today. As a previous and a present owner of Lincoln, I'm excited to see this new concept of the Navigator. I got to see the clay version of this in Detroit about a year ago, and there's a lot of similarities.
You can hear the cameras clicking there. A little bit of star power added to the big unveiling. Joining us on the opening bell, David Woodhouse, a designer for the Lincoln Navigator. Big day for you yesterday, David. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Steve.
This is a pretty sleek, luxurious-looking vehicle. Tell us its big attraction points.
Well, you know, a year ago we were here with the Continental Concept. It's always great to get back to New York. And for us, obviously, Navigator is a pretty iconic nameplate, and it's awesome from a design perspective to vision where, you know, in future where that could be coming down the road.
So give us a little bit of what it has under the hood, what it has behind the wheel, what it has on the dash.
Yeah, so this is a concept car. So we're not talking about the platform or any of the technical bits this year. We'll be back, you know, sometime next year with the production car. But at the moment, it's a concept, so it's really about ideas around, you know, protection, family, social aspects of the interior.
The vehicle, I've put a photograph of it out on Twitter, but it has steps that come down off of it. It's apparently going to have Wi-Fi, digital screens, that sort of thing. What is the future that Lincoln is headed here, and how does this vehicle play into that?
Well, you know, Navigator is a very important vehicle for us. It's one of our most recognized nameplates. It's one of our youngest buyers, would you believe? And, you know, we have to... Basically, we've delivered four vehicles in 4 years. This begins the new chapter for Lincoln. And, you know, this vehicle demonstrates the new face of Lincoln on an SUV for the first time, the new grille. And we have a lot of, as you say, really cool ideas around the interior and the social aspects of how people can use the vehicle and interact inside.
Concept cars, concepts often change before vehicle goes into mass production. Do you expect much to change with this? What do you think the final Navigator is going to look like?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we've had a good cadence with Lincoln of concept to production over the last 5 years. And if you, I don't know if you saw the Continental concept last year, but this would be, and then we came back early this year with a production car. This will be a similar level of change, so you can expect the car to be pretty similar when we show it next year.
The Lincoln is pretty much, you know, has been criticized in the auto press for missing this SUV boom that seems to be going on. It's a big factor at this New York Auto Show. Is this something that Lincoln is going to quickly get in on the action with?
No, Steve, I don't think we've missed the boom at all. We've got MKC and MKX, which are both... you know, the smaller and mid-size SUVs. So we've been right there through the last few years.
When I opened the segment, we were talking about how Lincoln wants to move toward what the company's calling quiet luxury as a designer of vehicles. What does that mean?
Yeah, quiet luxury we take really seriously within the company. It's really our mantra. And in design terms, we talk about that as being the exteriors of the vehicles being very elegant and very beautiful. And on the interiors, we want our interiors to be really a sanctuary, like a decompression tank. So that's really what it means to us.
So when do you think this would go into production? What is the process for taking a concept to actual floor of production floor?
Yeah, it will be next year. We don't know when yet, but it'll be sometime next year that we launch the production car.
It's the Navigator Lincoln concept vehicle on display at the 2016 New York International Auto Show. David Woodhouse, the designer for Lincoln Navigator. David, thanks for being with us on the opening bell this morning.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Steve.
The New York Auto Show, by the way, continues. As we reported yesterday and today, the crossover, the SUV, big-time floor display area for those models. If you get a chance to head to their website, you can also find them on Twitter at New York Auto, NY Auto Show. Boy, some really nice-looking cars were displayed yesterday. And if you were listening to the program yesterday, we told you that the New York Auto Show, this show is the largest in the country for auto shows, even above Chicago and Detroit, believe it or not.
You're listening to the opening bell on 720 WGN.
It's 548 on the WGN market desk. Dow futures off about 77 points. S&P futures off 10. The NASDAQ futures off 24 this morning. Crude oil trading down almost a buck. Now below $40 a barrel, $39 a barrel. Let's get the latest on commodities now. Here's Orion Samuelson.
Steve, thank you and good morning, everyone. Another reminder that today is our last trading day this week on U.S. markets and most global markets. They'll all be closed tomorrow in observance of Good Friday. Activity yesterday in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, it was the fifth straight day of losses for cattle futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. A lot of chart-related selling came in, and traders are expecting weaker cash cattle prices as well. The April live cattle contract ended 97 cents lower for the day. Packers in Kansas bid $135 for market-ready cash cattle. Sellers had them priced at $141, so you know what happened. There were no trades taking place in the cash cattle market. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a good day as well. It's 5:50 now on the opening bell. The business of sports up next. The Carm is here. Mark Carman and Dave Ennett, our sports director, joining us for our discussion this morning. Mark, welcome to the program again.
Good morning, Steve.
Good to see you. Bidding on the Big Ten's futures underway. What's going on with the television rights?
Yeah, Big Ten futures are up as well. The contract for the new TV deal is coming new at the end of the 2016-2017 deal. So apparently everybody wants in on this. CBS, ESPN, Fox, NBC, Turner Sports, all a part of the bidding. And right now you've got ABC has two games regionally. You also see games on ESPN, ESPN2, and then, of course, on the Big Ten Network as well. And Dave, of course, is extremely involved in this. I know it's the business of it as well. It just seems like it just keeps going up and up and up. And the Big Ten seems to want to be on ESPN because the most eyes are on ESPN.
Well, and I think they've had a good relationship with them over the years. But I think it's a great time. If you're the Big Ten, it's a great time for these rights to be up because you've got not only the impact that Ohio State has on the national landscape. You've had Michigan State, a major player nationally the last couple of years in terms of the bowl picture, and now you've got Michigan and Jim Harbaugh, which is probably creating more headlines in the offseason than any program around. So, I think from a standpoint of attracting an audience, they've got a lot going for them, plus the usual standards that the Big Ten has always had. So I think they're in a pretty good position.
Yeah, and it's not just, I should add, it's not just football. I mean, basketball, too. CBS, right, is in there. They've got 24 men's and women's basketball games, including the semis and the finals of the Big Ten tournament as well. And that's, we're in tournament time there. Football's the big money, but basketball's got a lot of dough, too.
Yeah, no question about that. And the Big Ten tournament has become a big attraction. But it hasn't really been broken. What I guess comes into play here is the chance to increase the revenue because from a programming standpoint, the Big Ten is able to spread it around. They get a lot of exposure, and ESPN seems like it's been good for them.
I mean, maybe the biggest home run the conference has hit as far as starting they were the first one to start their own network, and, mm-hmm. and they were also partnering out. They really couldn't have done it any better.
Yeah.
I have to admit, my only Big Ten interaction is with Dave Ennett and Northwestern, the Wildcats, Go Cats.
We appreciate that.
Here on the radio. But are they forward-looking guys? Are they looking for forward to small screens and the technology that we discussed during the Super Bowl that, the NFL's headed in that direction?
Well, what, the Big Ten?
Yeah, the Big Ten.
I think so, certainly. And I think everybody's looking that way right now, and I think you have to be. And in terms of down the road streaming, I mean, this is where everything is going. And the Big Ten, like a lot of conferences, they make all of their games available on mobile products and on their website. So, I mean, you are able to access one way or the other, you're able to access their games.
I mean, my favorite thing that Dave does is you can, when you're at Welsh Ryan Arena, they just, boom, turn around the highlights. So halftime, you get to hear Dave on the big screen. Isn't that
Do they? I'm not aware of that.
Come on. How's your tournament pools looking, by the way? Do you know how much money's been gambled, what they guesstimate as far as, because, you know, all this is really off the
books. How many billions?
How many billions? 9.2 billion.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's a lot. And I think everybody's brackets are pretty much gone by now.
I had Michigan State winning it.
I hate to, before you have to run, Dave, to just briefly mention Joe Gargiola. Mm-hmm. You know, as a kid growing up, here's a guy that, you know, it's sort of synonymous with baseball. What have we lost in his passing?
Well, I think not only was he a tremendous baseball broadcaster and storyteller. I mean, for me, in the baby boomer generation, it was Saturday afternoons, Tony Kubek and Joe Garagiola on the game of the week. And it wasn't every day unless you were in a city like, well, Chicago. Obviously, you could see the Cubs every day and the White Sox, but in terms of that game of the week, the one chance to see other teams around Major League Baseball came on Saturday afternoons, and Joe Garagiola was the voice of that. But what I think you'll look back at with him is he was kind of a breed of broadcaster that we don't see anymore, because not only did he do baseball, but he hosted the Today Show. He filled in for Johnny Carson on the Tonight Show. He did just about everything in television, and I mean, there aren't many guys who are that versatile anymore. He was a guy widely respected, and I think, again, baseball relies on the storytellers, and he was an excellent storyteller.
What do we do to get more of those folks coming up? Is it even happening? Obviously, you're great at doing this, but there aren't a lot of folks out there that do this way.
Well, I think the business is so, everybody's kind of narrow casted now into a specific role. So I think it's changed a lot. Everybody has specific responsibilities. It's not like you could go and do a game and then host a game show and do all that. I mean, the business has changed.
Well, and also, I mean, you look back at like this, I mean, the game of the week, that was a huge forum. I mean,
right.
that was the only game going. I mean, that his personality, I mean, everybody knew who was calling that game. Now it's, I mean, they all sound great, but it's who's who. Nobody.
It's splintered more. Yeah. There are more national there's national broadcasts every night. So it's just different now.
Yeah, and it came at a time, too, I just remember the voice being on the radio all the time. Not necessarily television, it was just on the radio.
Yeah.
And I came from a Cardinals-Cubs household, so it was, you know, both were there.
It's a good upbringing, Steve.
Yeah. Boy, that had to be a healthy environment.
Character. I was the only Cubs fan in the whole house of Cardinals fans, by the way.
Way to battle.
Mark Carman, thank you very much. Dave Ennett, you can find Dave on Twitter at Dave Ennett, and obviously Mark Carman at The Carm, weekend host through WGN Radio. Good of you to be with us on the opening bell. Guys, that's our program for today.